Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, September 17th, Joe was joined by founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
Yes, it is Constitution Day and Citizenship Day, and this is an American federal observance that recognizes the adoption of the United States Constitution and those who have become U.S. citizens. It is observed on the 17th day of September, and check your watch, check your calendar, ask your smartphone. It is the 17th of September, and this is the day in 1787 that delegates in the Constitutional Convention signed the document in Philadelphia. Lest you think that we just slapped this show together and it's just by the seat of our pants, far from it. Both Beau and Teresa approached me a couple weeks ago and said, Constitution Day is coming up. We're on the show together. Can we start off and talk about Constitution Day? And impressed, incredibly impressed that they had planned. Because I'm not used to that, is wonderful. And then, of course, the subject is such importance, especially now. Add Roger Berkowitz and Bob Griffin into the conversation. So we're going to talk about the news of the day. I promise you we will. There are things that we need to get to. But I do want to stress and talk a little bit, because obviously this all fits in, about Constitution Day. And I know at least two of our guests are going to be speaking on the subject at their public libraries. And so it's a big deal and something that should be observed, and we will do exactly that on the program this morning to observe it. So, Beau Breslin, I'll let you start.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. This is this is a big day and on the calendar for me. I've been a student of the Constitution and I've taught and written and so on for 40 years now. So Constitution Day is a big deal, and I will just say one thing because I know people are eager to talk about the current events. The U.S. Constitution changed the world, and it has flaws, and I've always been a fan of trying to reform the U.S. Constitution, but it changed the world. Akhil Amar, the great Yale law professor, called it the linchpin of human history, not American history, human history. And the way it changed the world, it was the only written constitution in late 18th century America. If you put the Articles of Confederation, written national constitution, was the only one at the time. And today, of the 200-plus countries of the world, only three don't have a written constitution. It absolutely fundamentally changed the world. It's the most important document. Sorry, those who are Jeffersonians and the Declaration of Independence is not that. The U.S. Constitution is the most important document ever written. It ranks up there, King James Bible. And so I celebrate it every day, but certainly on September 17th.
Teresa.
Yes. And I think given all of the stories we're talking about today and all of what's going on in our country always, but particularly in the last couple of months, really understanding the Constitution is very important. And I'm wonky enough that I think book clubs, you know, could, as their book, they should consider the Constitution as a subject matter, just to have a better understanding of it. Or if you want to donate to libraries, you can get those pocket constitutions, and which are really great resource guides for schools, libraries, whatever. But the part that I want to mention today is something that I learned about a few years ago that really has made a big impression on me, which is that the U.S. Constitution is really based on the role of Native Americans in shaping our Constitution, because our U.S. Constitution, is the framework of it, is really based on what's something called the Great Law of Peace. And this was the guiding document for a coalition of six Native American tribes who together became the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And these were six warring nations. They were fighting amongst one another. And the person became known as the Great Peacemaker, brought them together and over many years worked in conjunction with all of them to try to figure out a way where they could operate independently but live together in a coherent way and have some shared resources. And they developed the Great Law of Peace, and it was finalized actually through an event in Cohoes, New York, where I'm from. And if you go to the Cohoes Falls Overlook Park, there is actually a plaque there because several years ago, some land was returned to the descendants because it's considered sacred land where the Great Law of Peace was finalized. But these troops, the tribes, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Senecas, and they came together. And if you put the Great Law of Peace side by side with our Constitution, you'll see that it's really the basis of that. And Ben Franklin came to Albany and learned of it, met with some tribal leaders, went back to Philadelphia. They came, some Native American leaders came to Philadelphia and helped shape what our Constitution currently is. Now, interestingly enough, one of the things that the original founding fathers left out was the important role of women in the Great Laws of Peace, and it took them quite a long time to get up to speed on that. But in any case, I urge you to PBS, just Google it. You can find information in PBS. But in other places, there was the Senate hearings in 1987 that affirmed that our Constitution was framed on the Great Law of Peace and the role of Native Americans in shaping our country. So I just wanted to share that because it was an oh, wow moment for me when I first learned it. And I just think now more than ever, we need to remind ourselves about what our Constitution is, what its origins came from, how it's been shaped over time, and how it's being reshaped this year.
Well, Roger Berkowitz.
Thanks, Joe. The Constitution is a written document, and it has different parts. I think when I went to law school, and I think many of us who studied law, and I think many of us in the United States think of the Constitution, we often highlight the Bill of Rights, right? The first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which were not actually in the Constitution when it was written. They were added in as a compromise at the end, and really weren't that important in the first 100 years of the country. It became much more important in the 20th century. There's a question of what part of the Constitution is sort of central today. The Bill of Rights are central, and they've become part of what it means to be an American. The First Amendment, which you know is an absolute bulwark of the United States, is essential. But when I teach constitutional law, we often focus, at least for most of the class, on the structural separation of powers. That was one of the great innovations of the United States. Comes out of Montesquieu. Comes out of as well the Roman and Italian city states. And the question is, how do you prevent any one organization power from taking over, from becoming a tyranny? That's what the founders were really obsessed with. And they knew that any one branch, any whether it's executive, legislative, or the courts, could become tyrannical. And so they thought, not only do we want to create three branches, but we want to create the states and we want to create local communities. And what they tried to do was disperse power through as many different organizations, as many different institutions as possible. And the idea was that if one power got too powerful, one ring to control them all, others would gang up to oppose them. And that structural federalism, that structural separation of powers, dispersal of powers, is to me one of the great innovations, the rejection of sovereignty in the United States, that there's one institution that is sovereign. And that's what leads to the kind of democratic contestation and sometimes violence at the core of the United States. And yet it also is what I think is at the source of the protection of liberty and freedom here.
Bob Griffin.
You know, Joe, almost every single topic that we talk about is linked back to the Constitution. So whether we talk about Bondi's conversation about hate speech, whether we talk about military attacks on boats in open waters, whether we talk about the potential closure of the government because Congress can't pass a budget, these are all linked back to this seminal document. And I agree with you, Teresa, that people need to read the document. They also, I think, we should be teaching civics at a greater level and in multiple levels of our education system, much more so than we have in the past. I think we became complacent as a country, thinking that laws were settled and that these rights that we have are guaranteed, and they're not. And we're seeing that right now. I can tell you in my time in both government and in life, I've never felt that the Constitution is more under threat than it is today. And, Roger, I really appreciate your comments about the idea of the balance of power. And Beau's comments about the Constitution is an imperfect document. And the idea of trying to treat it as if it's some God-given or ordained language, it wasn't. It was an act of compromise. It was an act of balance. And in many respects, it purposely created an inefficient system in order to protect the core civil liberties and the idea of that we don't have a sovereign. So when we talk about the Supreme Court giving sovereign-like immunity to the president, when we talk about rollback of civil liberties, when we talk about control of the press, when we talk about government agencies being used specifically to further the personal ambitions of a family, these are all constitutional issues. And I know, I don't know how many articles we're going to get to today or issues we're going to get to today, Joe, but every one of them is connected back to the Constitution. I'm sorry, one final thought before you go on. The Constitution is a document that needs our protection. Because it's a at right now where we are, it's what saves the people from the oligarchs.
Roger,
yeah, I want to just follow up on that because I think it's really important. I mean, the Constitution is an imperfect document, right? As you said, and yet I think that what really made America into the kind of country in which freedom was valued and seen as a beacon around the world was this worship of the Constitution that came about in the 19th century. And it wasn't a worship of the document, of the paper. It was a worship of the idea that the Supreme Court had authority, that they would be able to, you know, we didn't always agree with them, but they were the people who were trying to interpret the Constitution. And it was what bound us as a people. And today, with every article in which you say, well, decided by an appointee by Obama or decided by an appointee by Biden, which on the one hand, I understand it. People care about these things. On the other hand, it does increasingly delegitimize law and the rule of law and the idea of a constitutional republic, which is what we are. And if that continues and if people keep thinking of it that way, you're never going to get back the kind of respect for constitutional republicanism, small r republicanism that we need. And so I think all of us have – it's a tough call. Do you identify who the judges are? I mean, or do you not? And obviously it's become politicized, so it's sort of a head in the sand kind of moment if you don't. And yet we're in that kind of double bind.
Joe, do we have time for a quick story?
Beau, tell me a story.
Okay, so I can never resist the story. I'll keep it to a minute or so, but it builds off of what Bob and Roger were talking about in terms of reverence and worship for the Constitution, and what Teresa was talking about in terms of understanding and reading it. So we're back in late 18th century America. Anti-federalists, those who oppose ratification of the Constitution, want a Bill of Rights, and Roger mentioned the Bill of Rights. Madison makes the pledge, right? He's running for Congress, and he makes the pledge that he'll put a Bill of Rights. That'll be the first order of business when he gets into Congress. He wins his election. He goes to Congress. And the first order of business is he has a list of freedoms, a list of Bill of Rights. This was a compromise to the Anti-Federalists in exchange for ratification. There are 19 on that list. You can see his original list in the National Archives. I implore people to go to the National Archives and see his original list. So Madison proposes 19 amendments. 19 is consolidated to 17. 17 becomes 12 because 2/3 of both houses pass 12 of those, and 10 are eventually ratified by the states. That's why we have 10 rights in the Bill of Rights. But two things that are important about this story. One is his First Amendment, the First Amendment that we think of sort of first among equals with the right of freedom of speech and freedom of religion and the Establishment Clause, freedom of the press, and so on, was his third. It was not his first. And the reason why, and this is the point I want to make, the reason why it was third is because Madison believed the constitutional amendments ought to just be embedded in the actual text, Bob. They're not additions to the end of the document. He thought they should be embedded in the original text. And so Congress shall make no law, ... ought to be in Article 1, Section 8. And when it became clear that it was not going to be embedded in the actual text, that has had repercussions for American society since, because we see the original constitutional text as unamendable, as sacred, as worshipful, reverential, because you cannot change the original text. Amendments go at the end. They're seen as additions. But the original text technically has not changed since 1787, and that contributes to our worship, which I would say is a problem.
But it's worship, but it's also an interpretation, and things that did not seem to be, for want of a better term, well, I think it's an accurate term, for a crisis, where we're wringing our hands and saying, oh, my God, I didn't think that could happen under our Constitution. Those things are happening. So,
sure.
So it's our interpretation that is changing.
Well, sort of. So, and historically, there have been moments of crisis, the Civil War being the most prominent. But not only. I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan. But if you really want to know who changed the scope of executive power, it's FDR. You know, and sure. Trump is testing every possible limit from this moment on, and this is probably a good segue into our current conversation, current events conversation. But FDR was the big sort of game changer for executive power. And so, yes, you're right, Joe. Interpretation has made a big difference, and in many ways, interpretation by the Supreme Court has changed the direction of the country in ways that Roger alluded to. At the end of the day, though, our Constitution is still 8 out of 10 people still revere it, and it is filled with flaws. Now, I'm trying to be joyful all day because that's the theme of the day. So I'll go back to my point that the Constitution changed the world in a positive way.
That was Beau Breslin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 17th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, September 18th, Joe was joined by Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College and is a specialist on the history of U.S. foreign policy, Robert Brigham, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, and mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan.
So let's talk about what happened yesterday. This is one of those things that I think is shocking, although not surprising. It is something that it's keeping in line with the character of this administration, if there is such a thing. Walt Disney Corporation-owned broadcaster ABC said it is pulling Jimmy Kimmel Live indefinitely. And I do want to stress the wording there of Jimmy Kimmel Live being pulled indefinitely. The president in his Truth Social remarks several times said that the show had been canceled. We have not heard from Kimmel. We have not heard from Disney. So we're assuming that the original statement that was made in indefinitely is on hiatus indefinitely. But the question is, will that show ever come back? And we can talk about that in a moment. This is following backlash over the host's remarks about slain right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. The move comes after station owner Nexstar Media Group says it would yank the show from its ABC affiliate stations as a result of the comments. The Irving, Texas-based Nexstar announced Wednesday that Kimmel would be off its stations for the foreseeable future. Nexstar strongly objects to recent comments made by Mr. Kimmel concerning the killing of Charlie Kirk and will replace the show with other programming in its ABC-affiliated markets, which includes the Albany market, I should note, a company representative said in a statement. Kimmel said during a monologue on Monday that Tyler Robinson, the Utah man accused in the shooting death of Kirk, might have been a pro-Trump Republican. He said MAGA supporters, quote, are desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it. Kimmel then mocked the president for talking about the construction of a new White House ballroom after being asked how he was reacting to the murder of his close ally. Law enforcement officials revealed Tuesday that Robinson had liberal political leanings and expressed disdain for Kirk in communications with his roommate. I do want to get to the statement, and I thought I had it here, but I can't find it right away, where the head of the FCC, Brendan Carr, blasted Kimmel, threatened to take action. He said two things, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but one was, we can do this the hard way or we can do this the easy way. Tell me how that's not a threat. Also, and who says that in their daily life? That it was some of the most sickening content he had ever heard.
He doesn't watch much TV.
I mean, look, 15 minutes of Love Island. Come on. That's some of the most sickening content on TV. So this is where we're at the moment. The question is, what will happen with the show? And of course, the larger question is what this means just in general with the remarks that have been made of taking on what we heard from the Vice President of the United States when he hosted Charlie Kirk's show, his podcast from the White House on Monday, and talked about how they were going to be going after these groups, saying that it was a network. And then there was the president's action yesterday in talking about Antifa being a terrorist organization. And then on top of that, Pam Bondi talking about free speech. So there's a lot coalescing here together in just the week since Charlie Kirk was killed tragically, that a lot of action against not just people who have a reaction, but people certainly almost exclusively on the left who have been, and I think I say this with I believe the facts on my side, that people that the president has tangled with in the past.
Well, he's gone after the academics, and he's gone after various segments of our society, and he certainly has gone after the media. And this is another brick on the load. But I you know, there's so many ways to look at this whole episode, or so many ways to peek your way into the various permutations of it. But I can't help but thinking that the ownership of these stations, and to a different extent, the ABC and CBS with the Colbert incident, are bowing down. They're not fighting back. There is a defense here. We're defending against the First Amendment. We're defending against the independence of media in this country. And right now, I suspect that there are a lot of the newsrooms in this country that are chilled. They don't need to put the air conditioning on because they're all looking over their shoulders and know that there's a good chance that their bosses aren't going to stand up for them.
A couple of things. One is that the show did not run last night. Obviously, it was canceled right before the taping was to have taken place. Mr. Kimmel had planned to address the backlash to his comments during the Wednesday telecast, according to those familiar with the program, but Disney executives made the decision to suspend the show before taping began. And this was not said, I'm sure most of you know this, but this does come right on the heels of CBS canceling The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, ending a network franchise for over three decades after next May. CBS said the cancellation was for financial reasons, but many in the media industry have speculated that it was done to curry favor with the Trump administration while Paramount's merger was pending. And guess what? In this case, there is a merger pending as well.
I mean, in the Project 2025, Brendan Carr wrote the essay on the FCC. And this is the playbook from that. And this isn't the first time the FCC has been weaponized, especially over mergers. To me, that says a couple of things. One, that we need public radio and public TV now more than ever, because these corporations are bowing in many ways to the pressure because they know they're going to have to come before the FCC for these merger approvals.
Oh, let me interrupt you just for a second. 800-323-9262. Please go on.
But what strikes me, besides the obvious use of the FCC here to do the administration's cleaning up, is that in the past 10 years, no politician, present company included, has benefited more from a free press than Donald Trump. The whole podcast world has benefited from this. And so it seems to me that there is going to be a backlash among Trump supporters. For example, already Senators Grassley, Hawley, and Tillis has spoken out very, very strongly against these kind of attacks by the FCC. Of course, Grassley had to add that the Obama administration is the one that really showed Trump how to do this by weaponizing the IRS to go after conservative groups. So I think it's going to go back and forth. This isn't the first time the FCC has played this kind of role as watchdog in this way, in a political way. But I think there are enough people out there who in the Republican Party who see this as a problem going after First Amendment rights.
Well, and I also think that this is really about money, that the concentration of media empires that we've seen since the deregulation that occurred, that was supported in a bipartisan way. So it's not you can't point one finger at one party or the other, but this has eroded over time, and it has allowed these media companies to be held by very wealthy and powerful people who are focused on the money. You know, the days of, I think, you know, with the passing of Robert Redford, you know, you go back and look at all the president's men and this time during the Watergate crisis when we saw these powerful media companies taking on the president and really demanding freedom of the press. You think about the Pentagon Papers, all of that, and that just seems so quaint now. And I think what layered on top of this is the fact that none of us, I don't certainly have confidence in a Supreme Court right now to say anything or do anything that will prevent what's happening from continuing to happen. I mean, you know, the case law is clear, time, place, and manner. There can be restrictions on free speech, but they have to be based on time, place, and manner. That's why you can't say certain things at certain times of the night. But to describe what Kimmel said as something that, you know, it basically requires censorship, that is a bridge too far. I can't imagine a Supreme Court agreeing to that except this Supreme Court. So that's the situation that we're in.
For the record, Jimmy Kimmel said, "We hit some new lows over the weekend with the MAGA gang desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it." That was apparently what the MAGA group and those who put the pressure on both Tuesday and Wednesday were upset about. And as I said, again, the FCC chairman, Mr. Carr, saying that that was a concerted effort to lie to the American people. The FCC was going to have remedies that we can look at, and said that it was sickening.
But you know, so he wasn't a newscaster. Like this wasn't. This is an entertainer, a comedian. To say that, to have somebody from the FCC say that, really speaks to the fact that we are not living in or with an administration that will uphold the right to free speech. Because that's just poppycock.
There you go.
I'm trying not to swear.
Yeah, I thought that was the name of the dance you did, was the poppycock. So 2 points, and then we'll take a quick break. But 2 points I want to make really quickly. One is that Brendan Carr went on Sean Hannity last night and said that the then sort of shifting, let's say, blame to both Nexstar and Sinclair, the other organization that decided not to air this program, as unprecedented. And I'm very glad to see that America's broadcasters are standing up to serve the interests of their community, Mr. Carr said. We don't just have this progressive foie gras coming out from New York and Hollywood. This is an important turning point. I will also mention that yesterday in his reporting, the CNN media reporter Brian Stelter, who had been in a conversation via text with Commissioner Carr, wrote to him once the decision was made and the show had been pulled and said, "What do you think of it?" And Mr. Carr responded with a meme from the TV show The Office of Steve Carell and Rainn Wilson and their characters partying in the office and doing a victory dance. We do have a lot of letters on this, so let me get to them. Peter said, "In case you haven't noticed, this country is all about money, not democracy. As long as the wealthy get richer, to hell with democracy. Get used to it. And by the way, this country has always been about the money." That from Peter. Hard to argue. But
well, let's face it. I mean, this is not a newspaper issue, but it is a newspaper issue, all media issue, and media is in difficult straits right now, and money is not to be scoffed at, because if there's no money, there's no media. So, but that doesn't mean it can't be done the right way and responsibly.
This is a point from a listener made that it was one of the first things that struck me when I heard the news yesterday, and it's yet another example. But Alan writes and says, "The same week of the Kimmel incident, the main Fox anchor stated that homeless people should receive an involuntary lethal injection, And there was no pearl clutching on the right. Explain to me who the snowflakes are again. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to mention that Brian Kilmeade, and they allowed him to make some sort of an apology the next day, but it certainly did not have the, you use your word, kerfuffle that came out with Kimmel to start, but a host of other people who, Matthew Dowd on ABC said something that was considered intemperate and he was immediately fired. Kilmeade should have been fired by those standards.
A poppycock. Purple, I believe, is the term.
But, you know, and I think, look, people can go back in time and point to people getting canceled and making apologies and stepping it in and what you say and what you can't say. But I think part of the reason that we're not hearing more of an outcry from Democrats is that I think most Democrats do believe in that people have the right to say what they want to say, even if we disagree with it. And so I think, again, this is an area where we're kind of caught flat-footed because – It is a fundamental part of our democracy, this freedom of speech, and people have the right to say things that make me really mad and that I don't agree with, but they have the right to say it. And for the Republicans, you know, Donald Trump uses this word all the time. He talks about fairness. This is now things are going to be fair, you know, playing on this trope that somehow this, you know, white male victimhood, we haven't been able to say what we want to say. We've been censored. We have been put upon. And that's what he plays on. And that's how you can have this absurdity, right, of calling the Ford Foundation a terrorist organization and yet pardoning people who literally attacked the capital of this country.
$15 billion lawsuit against the New York Times.
Yeah. Some of the speculation I've heard about that is, do you think he's doing it because he wants to put the New York Times out of business? Or does he realize that this lawsuit has no merit and it won't go anywhere, but the fact that he's filed it and is standing up to the New York Times will play well with his supporters?
I canceled my Paramount Plus subscription the morning after they canceled Colbert, whom I can still watch for free via the free CBS app, this morning following the news that ABC canceled Jimmy Kimmel for making what was a truly non-comment about Charlie Kirk. I canceled my subscription to Hulu, which shares the same owner as ABC. Corporations that bow to an American dictator rather than defend their and our constitutional rights can do without my money. I understand, Doug. I'm not there yet. I'm not at the point of canceling my subscriptions. Not that I won't be, but I do have to say that because I think the anger should be going more toward the administration and the FCC than it should be toward ABC.
Yeah, I agree with you, Joe. And I think part of the problem here is how the FCC is constituted. The president gets to pick five commissioners. They're confirmed by the Senate. And then there's absolutely no congressional oversight after that. And there have been efforts in the past to revise this standard and to bring the FCC more in line with other regulatory industries, and it's probably these incidents are probably going to spark that debate again, and maybe there'll be a change. It does seem to me to be an awful lot of power without any oversight at all.
That was Robert Brigham on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 18th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, September 19th, Joe was out and David Gustina hosted. He was joined by former EPA Regional Administrator, Professor at Bennington College, and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Rydell.
Well, listen, I think you probably guessed where we're going here. This is from the Washington Post. CDC advisors make their first childhood vaccine edit. Oh, by the way, listeners, panel at WAMC.org is how to get in touch with us. You may want to react to this story. Federal vaccine advisors voted Thursday to roll back a childhood vaccine recommendation, marking the first change to the routine immunization schedule under Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is helming a broad review of vaccines he has maligned for years. In an 8-3 vote, with one member abstaining. Wow. The 12-member advisory committee on immunization practices, handpicked by Kennedy, recommended skipping a combination measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox vaccine given to about 15% of children receiving their first dose of vaccination for those diseases until the child is at least four. The combination vaccine, which is different from the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine that children more commonly receive, has typically been administered to children between 12 and 15 months of age. The panel recommended that children under four get separate vaccines, ones against measles, mumps, rubella, and another for chicken pox. The recommendation now goes to the acting head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who will decide whether to make it the official government recommendation. Well, who wants to start?
I'll start.
Sienna.
I feel very passionate about this because I think what I was saying is, on one hand, we have this big, beautiful act, which is going to lead to almost 4.8 million people losing coverage by 2034. It eliminates certain eligibility for some immigrant groups, such as refugees and asylees. So all these people are going to be losing their access to health care at the same time that our access to health care is becoming more difficult. Because now they're saying that in order to, for at least the hepatitis B one, in order to, they're delaying the hepatitis B for infants now under the assumption that the mother has been screened. And what if the mother has not been screened? That's why they were doing it earlier. And it's just, it feels like they're taking away both hands. They're making it harder for everyone.
Didn't your mother ever say, don't assume? Sorry.
Threw me off on my tangent. But it's just, it's really, really hard as a mother to figure out what you need to do for your children, what they need. And it is so important to be able to depend on the CDC or your government to have certain things in line that they've cleared, that you know they've read through all the reports and they decided this is the best course of action. To be able to rely on that is so important when you're dealing with so many different other factors in life, especially now when people are trying to figure out how they can eat every day and groceries are expensive. Now they have to think about the fact that I have to get this separate measles vaccine for my child. And I need to find time to schedule another appointment to go back and get the second part of that vaccination. You know how hard it is to get just logistics to get an appointment once a year to go in for your child to get their shots and to get them out of school, to take time off of work. Just the logistics to it. It's just making it harder to get these vaccinations, harder for everyone to be covered. And it's terribly frustrating seeing this when it's also coupled with the fact that they're rolling back funding of things like Medicaid, where people would have access to medical care and other provisions in the ACA.
And this is just, once again, yet another example of how these cuts that seemingly affect the most vulnerable sectors in society aren't just going to affect those people. It's not just going to affect immigrants, for example. Infectious diseases are going to affect us all.
All of us.
It's going to affect us all. Stick with the immigrant community. They don't stay in the states that are maybe more lax about it. We will all be affected. I was just reminded of the 2019 measles outbreak in Brooklyn, the largest in decades in the United States. Now, it may be your choice to vaccinate your child or not, but those who were really affected were, for example, pregnant women who had been late with renewing the MMR shot and were deeply worried about the way it would affect their unborn child, for example. Can I actually just add on to this? Because it, sure. from the sounds of it, and again, I'm no expert in that regard at all, but from the sounds of it, the actual impact, the initial impact on our access to vaccines for our children is not going to be limited. But what I found really fascinating is that the background story to the panel, because half of the panel apparently was just picked this week. And you could see that in the way they examined and discussed the matters at hand. Many of them didn't even know what the impact of the vaccine was. They had no data in front of them. They had to be told what the rules are. And based on that, what I would call no knowledge, they came to a conclusion. I think that didn't make it to hepatitis B.
They didn't make it yet. It's coming out today or something. It's happening today. Or...
Yeah, they were too busy with the MMR.
Well, I mean, just to remind everybody, Kennedy fired every member of the vaccine panel in June. And most of his replacements have criticized coronavirus vaccine policies. This is from the Washington Post. Former CDC Director Susan Menares, who we witnessed testifying, said she was fired after refusing to rubber stamp recommendations from the reformulated committee, and several top vaccine leaders resigned in protest. The idea that Americans' health is being endangered by the very place we relied on, that's probably more frightening than anything else we talked about today, because by those actions, any one of us is at risk, and we don't know. We just don't know when or where or how that might happen. And how many people did we witness during the coronavirus die?
And here comes the lawyer with her briefcase. But eventually, this is going to lead to lawsuits. I mean, I care more about what's happening with the public health because that's more immediate. But this is going to lead to lawsuits. We're going to pull those minutes and those records to see how in-depth they looked at, what reports they looked at, who did they listen to. And if they did something that was not in the public interest and we can prove it, it's going to lead to some legal lawsuits.
Judith?
Well, the CDC is a mess. I mean, Bobby Kennedy Jr. is a washed-up Clean Water Act lawyer who is now making public policy not based on science. And what's really unfortunate is, yeah, there's a 12-member advisory committee, but he has stacked the deck and appointed people who he has pre-selected, who he thinks agrees with him. Reasonable people can debate whether you wait till age 4 on some of these vaccines, whether you spread them out, if you can, as mentioned, if you can actually get the appointment. But the problem is this CDC has zero credibility. They are not making decisions based on sound science. You know, even Trump was questioning what was going on in Florida with DeSantis' policy on vaccines. But Trump just gets quick clips on Fox News and doesn't follow up even when he has concerns. But this is a very serious situation. It will affect herd immunity. I think all we can do is listen to our own doctors and listen to medical associations. American Academy of Pediatrics is a much better source of guidance for parents than the CDC. And it's just... it's just tragic. There's going to be additional illness, infectious disease, death, because Bobby Kennedy doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, and you mentioned Florida, which is a real problem. Here in the Northeast, we've seen states like New York and Massachusetts saying, no, we're going to make sure you can get the shots you need when you need them. And, you know, this is where we're hopefully... I shouldn't say hopefully. I said this is where we should be worrying, in my opinion, about what we were told when the coronavirus hit. It's not if, but when another pandemic hits. Mm-hmm. And we're not prepared for that, I can only imagine at this point.
And vaccination It shouldn't be something for only the privileged can get. Right. And that's what it starts happening. If insurance doesn't cover it because the CDC doesn't recommend it, then only certain people can afford to have vaccinations. Only certain people have these. And that's a terrible way to function in our society. Go ahead, Judith. I'm sorry.
No, that's OK. The three senior people at CDC who either were fired or resigned out of protest. And Susan Manaris, by the way, was a recent Trump appointee, and she didn't last more than a month. They have all said publicly that the U.S. is woefully unprepared for any future infectious disease outbreak. And we certainly saw that in Texas with the measles outbreak, where it was largely unvaccinated kids. Kids, by the way, who are not making these decisions, but their poorly informed parents are. So this is, you know, this is quite a serious situation, and we also appreciate, I also appreciate the West Coast governors and the Northeast governors coming together to make sure that we all have access to COVID vaccines, which is going to be really, really important, particularly this winter, if we want to avoid another shutdown and avoid just getting COVID, which is, you know, pretty brutal if you've had it, and concerns about long COVID. But are we living in a world now where you only get protection from COVID if you live in a state where the governor is making decisions on health policy based on science rather than political ideology? I mean, it's, and again, it's the...
Yes.
Yeah, we are. And the families in the states that don't have informed health departments are going to suffer.
And this one sort of heading back toward where we were earlier this morning, but a different subject. Can Trump actually designate Antifa, or Antifa, or however you say it, a terrorist group? First of all, I love that the New York Times, the article I'm looking at here, has some questions over each paragraph. And one of them is Antifa actually an organization? One word. No.
No.
So well, you know, this amorphous thing, how do you designate it anything? Then you can just pick any individuals you find and say, you're part of that group.
Exactly.
Sienna?
I mean, oh.
Yes.
Nodding my head.
Yes. Thank you for agreeing with me. Say something.
No, I completely agree. I think it's the fact that you are not allowed to have domestic terrorist groups. Right. Like that's part of the protection. That's part of the free speech. That's and that goes back to when I was looking into this and reading more about it. That's when I got onto my Chief Justice Roberts spiel, because I wanted to see how often he's protected this, because my main thing is, will the Supreme Court protect free speech at the end of the day when it comes to this? And it seems like this is something in the article we were reading mentioned that he'd protected it in the past. And so that's why I went back and did some other Roberts free speech record, where he's repeatedly protected it in 2010 when he struck down a ban on animal cruelty language, in 2011 when he upheld the Westboro Baptist protest at funerals. He upheld it in 2014 when he invalidated abortion clinic buffer zones. He's upheld it. He continues to uphold it. He says, in quote, however ugly, it is entitled to the highest protection. So I just think that this is something where Trump will not get far on at all. This is something where the court, at best, he might get a little Thomas, maybe a little Alito, but I think it's going to.
Yeah, I'll take a little Thomas, a little Alito.
But I just think that Roberts would not be able, with his record and the precedent as it shows legally, that he would not uphold this. And then what I found very interesting was I was like, okay, domestic terrorism is not allowed.
That's right.
But what we've heard recently, especially in our immigration world, is, you know, foreign terrorist groups, like drug cartels, are foreign terrorist groups now. And I was looking into that. And I was like, let me just see what's happening and what's the global response. And what I saw was the Mexican president, she was pointing out that you're calling our drug cartels, and she's referring to the U.S. She's saying, you're saying that it's a terrorist group, but you fund, and quote, 74% of the weapons that these groups use, the U.S. And so she was saying what they're thinking about doing is they need tighter controls, but she was talking about whether or not they could sue or some kind of lawsuit against the U.S. for funding these drug cartels that they call foreign domestic terrorists. So it was such an interesting cycle to watch and see what's happening. And like the input, like how do these foreign domestic groups, how are they formed and who funds them, who gives them material support, as they say, as Trump was saying, anyone that gives material support to domestic terrorism, terrorists would be in trouble. But in all actuality, it's the U.S. companies that are funding the foreign, giving material support to foreign terrorist organizations.
So is this empty rhetoric by Trump?
Yes.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. I don't think it's empty rhetoric. I mean, rhetoric matters. Right?
Yeah.
The messages that are sent matter, and as we can see. Right? I mean, it's like the division in the country and the rise in violence, the rise in political violence is very obvious. And this kind of language, this kind of rhetoric feeds into it. But, you know, it raises the question that I grapple with always, the differentiation between free speech and hate speech, and especially over the last few days, where it was just like the terms free speech and hate speech were thrown about without further explanation. I'm always reminded of one of my favorite quotes that I like to share with my students by Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, who said that our liberties are tested based on the actions of not very nice people. Now, the reason why I've always been fascinated with hate speech, not just specifically, but in terms of like the significance to our political system, is because did you know that hate speech is protected only in the United States? There is no other democracy in the world where hate speech is protected. And that tells me so much about the political culture here in the United States. And I've been grappling with that because I do, as someone who hasn't grown up here, I do question, is it necessary? Freedom of speech, without a doubt, no democracy can function without our right to criticize the government and government policies. That's what freedom of speech is about. But so why is hate speech protected? Why is it so important here in this particular country, unlike in other democracies, to take it a step further and say, we will also protect the worst, right? The worst kind of viewpoints that most of us find upsetting. Why is it so important? I have thoughts, but I would like to hear Sienna's thoughts on that as a lawyer.
Good luck, Sienna. We're waiting.
I mean, here we go.
And let me just say, and I'll give you a moment to breathe. I've had mixed feelings about it. At this point, seeing how speech has been weaponized, I actually err on the side of saying, no, let's protect it on both sides, to just protect us from having the leadership misuse speech against us, right? It's like, but it's a fascinating question. Why is it the case that here we are the only country that actually protects speech?
But this is case in point why it's so important right now that we don't that we do protect hate speech, right?
Yes.
Because what is hate speech is objective. And I think that's the concern. And that's when I said that I think this is just rhetoric, because I think in practice it fails, right? Who do you send? You send the FBI after somebody because they put something up in terms of, and Antifa for a while was Black Lives Matter. So if someone put that out on their lawn, we have FBI standing out to arrest them because they spoke, because they think they're part of Antifa, because maybe they sent money to a Black Lives Matter organization. Is that material support? What is material support? Mm. You have to define it. And so I just think that's why I think it's just rhetoric, because in practice, and that's why I think I always remind people a lot, is a lot of the things he does, especially via executive order, sometimes it is effective, but other times it's just like, how does this work logistically? Like, my brain always goes logistically. How do we work? How do we defend against it? And that's one of those things that would be a slippery slope, as we say in the legal community. Because just imagine, I heard one podcaster say, one day, you guys, when President AOC is in office and she decides that who's part of X, Y, and Z groups are all of a sudden domestic terrorists and they go round them up, you guys will be upset. So when the pendulum swings, everyone will be upset. So they have to be careful about what kind of precedents they're setting. And I think that people on both sides of the aisle are starting to see that.
That was Sienna Freeman-Tolbert on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 19th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.